Let's start with our motivation. Again, coming back to the preciousness of this life. Whether we're sick, whether we're well, we can still make our lives meaningful by using our mind in the proper way, by cultivating great aspirations, compassion, unbiased love, wisdom. We can do so many things with our mind, no matter the state of our body. And so really appreciating the power of our mind, the potential that having a human mind brings us. Then let's ensure that we use our mind in a proper way to cultivate virtue, to cultivate bodhicitta, the aspiration for full awakening for the benefit of all beings, and the wisdom that realizes reality. So with this kind of motivation, let's listen and share the Dharma together this evening. So we're at the point in the text where we've discussed the practices of the initial level practitioner, somebody who, by the way, the initial level practitioner has two levels to it itself. One is somebody who just cares about the life, this particular life, and then the second one is the one who cares about future lives. So of the two, the second one is an actual Dharma practitioner. So that's the initial level practitioner. Then the medium level practitioner, we talked about the practice of that person who wants to be free from the cycle of constantly recurring problems or samsara. And now we're at the practice of the advanced level practitioner, somebody who aims for full awakening for the benefit of all beings. So the first part of this section is how do you generate that motivation that wants to attain full awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings? How do we generate the bodhicitta? Because we can't just say, bodhicitta, bodhicitta, great compassion, and then those things arise in our mind. You know, it's like we have to really think and investigate and ponder and look at our own experience quite a bit in order to transform our mind in that direction, because we already have a whole lot of imprints of self-centeredness and caring just for our own benefit. Not only our own benefit in, you know, I want the biggest piece of pie, or, you know, if there's a problem, you can have it. Not only are, you know, looking out for ourselves in that worldly way, but the self-centered attitude that says my spiritual liberation is more important than anybody else's. Yeah? And I'm going to work for my own liberation, and good luck everybody else. Okay, so really combating that kind of self-centered attitude. So we're going to be spending, you know, quite some time on the methods to generate bodhicitta. So one method is the seven-point cause and effect instruction, and the other method is equalizing and exchanging self for others. But before we do that, we have to talk about, you know, the benefits of bodhicitta, because as in, you know, most of the other topics that we study in the Lamrim, it talks about the benefits of doing this and the advantages, disadvantages of not doing it. Okay, so it's commercial time. basically, yeah. Except these are good kind of commercials. They are telling us to buy something that we don't need and use more than our fair share of world's resources. They're commercials promoting, you know, benevolence and great compassion and so on. So this is the kind of thing that we need to hear, because when we understand the benefits of bodhicitta, then we become really eager to engage in the meditation practices that lead to generating it. Just like with anything, you know, when we see the benefits, then we go towards it. If we don't see the benefits, then we just kind of like, well, who cares? Okay? So, actually, the best place to understand the benefits of bodhicitta from is the first chapter of Shantideva's text. Yeah, so we could do a detour and go do that whole chapter, but I think that would be too much of a detour. Okay, so we'll just cover some of the benefits here. Okay, so, you know, when we think of a bodhisattva as somebody who has the bodhicitta, who's aspiring for full awakening, this person cherishes others more than they cherish themselves. And when we think about that, that's kind of absolutely amazing that it's even possible. You know, because when we look in our lives, who do we think about all the time? Me, 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 me. Yeah, so, you know, just to think that there's beings who actually cherish others more than self, and that they're happy to do that, and that those people are happier than us, you know, that's the real shocker, that the people who cherish others are happier than we who cherish ourselves. Because you'd think that if we just focused on cherishing ourselves, then we would be able to get everything we wanted and we would be really happy. But that's what we've been doing until now, and you can't say that we're really happy, can you? Yeah. So, you know, it's encouraging us to try another way. So there's one verse here. It's from Chandragoman's text. Chandragoman is one of the ones who wrote a manual about the Bodhisattva precepts and listed the Bodhisattva precepts. He was a lay person, but he was at Nalanda. So here's a quote from one of his texts. It says, "The sun's great rays shine everywhere, traveling like a horse-drawn chariot. The ground supports the world without calculating the burden. Such is the nature of persons of great capacity," this advanced level practitioner, "who lack any self-interest. They are consumed with whatever brings happiness and benefit to the world." Yeah? So it's kind of, you know, making the analogy of the sun. The sun shines everywhere, but it doesn't have any exhaustion from doing that. Yeah, at the end of the day, the sun doesn't come, "Oh God, I shone in so many areas in the world. I'm just pooped out now, you know. I need a break." Or, you know, "I did all this shining today and then people complained because it was too hot." Yeah. So the sun doesn't do that. The sun just shines. There's no problem, you know, an exhaustion. And the ground supports the world without calculating the burden. Okay, so the ground, you know, we stomp on it, we walk on it, we dig it, we do everything, you know. And the ground doesn't go, "Oh God, you know, you weigh too much and you're stomping and again you're drilling into me and, you know, what do you want out of me already?" Okay, the ground just it bears everything, but doesn't see it as a burden. And so in the same way, you know, these bodhisattvas who are not concerned at all with their own welfare, except from the point of view of how actualizing their own spiritual aims can be a benefit to sentient beings. So they're consumed with whatever brings happiness and benefit to the world. So that's what occupies their mind. Yeah. So at the end of the month, they're not sitting there, you know, going through their checkbook and like, oh, I spent more money than I spent last month, and I have so many financial problems, and the credit card company charged me too much. You know, the bodhisattva isn't worried about that at the end of the month, you know. Their mind is directed towards, how can I bring peace and benefit to other living beings? So that, you know, when you have that mind that cherishes others, it frees you from the pain of all this self-centeredness. Now, it doesn't mean the bodhisattvas don't care about how much money they have in their checkbook. I mean, I think they know how to balance their checkbook and manage their money so that they don't become problems for other beings. But the point is, they're not worried about it and obsessed with it and afraid and so on, okay? Because they look at the things that preserve life as, yeah, you use them to keep yourself alive, but what's important in your life is to work for the happiness and welfare of other living beings. So that kind of love and compassion really frees them from a lot of the pain that we experience. Yeah, when you are unhappy, is your mind involved in cherishing others or cherishing yourself?
Preaching after others.
Huh? Preaching
after others.
Bitching.
After others.
After others. You mean first they bitch and then you do. You said bitching after others.
Yeah, that's what your mind is doing.
Okay, I think you meant bitching about others.
Yeah.
So I made a joke. So it's okay. I mean, when our mind is bitching about others, are we happy?
No.
No, we're miserable. Yeah, the mind is going round and around. They did this, they did that, they did that. Yeah. Okay, no happiness at all. Okay, so, remember we talked about Chandrakirti's quotation there, and in it we saw that the bodhicitta is the source of all happiness because Buddhas come from bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas, you know, are ones, people who have the bodhicitta. And from the Buddhas, teach all sentient beings. Here are solitary realizers and also us. And, all the virtue we create is because somehow there's, you know, we've heard some teachings about goodness and have been encouraged by, you know, either what we've been taught when we were kids or by other sentient beings to think of others' welfare. And so they say, because of that, that the bodhicitta is the source of all the good of self and others. Okay, it's actually the source of all good in the world. Yeah, but it's also the source of all good of self and others. Because if we don't have the bodhicitta, then we can't become Buddhas. If we can't become Buddhas, then we can't work most effectively for the welfare of other living beings. Okay, so the bodhicitta, as Jay Rinpoche says, is the origin of all good of self and others. It's the medicine that alleviates all troubles. Okay. So in one way, you know, how does bodhicitta alleviate all troubles? Well, it leads us to full awakening where we have eliminated all dukkha, all unsatisfactory conditions and their causes. Okay, and of ourself, and we're in the process of helping others do the same. But also, you know, just generating bodhicitta in our day-to-day life brings us a tremendous amount of happiness. Yeah. I remember, and even without bodhicitta, just generating some kind of compassion helps alleviate our pain. When I lived at Dorje Poma Monastery in France, one night I was up all night. I had some kind of infection in my big toe. We usually don't pay much attention to our big toe on a regular basis, do we? I mean, did you check in with your big toe this morning? Ask it out. No, we ignore our big toe. But when our big toe is infected, it hurts like crazy. And I, you know, the pain was just amazing. We lived, the monastery was out in the countryside, and, you know, somehow we never thought of going into the ER. So I was there in the I slept in the meditation hall that evening, you know, as a support to get through the pain. And I did the taking and giving meditation, you know, with compassion, imagining taking on others' suffering, with love, imagine giving them my happiness. And that's what kept me okay that whole night, despite that incredible pain. So just even in, you know, our daily life, if we're unhappy, if we're in physical pain, as soon as we turn our mind to compassion, and especially if we imagine taking on others' suffering and giving them our happiness, it completely changes our mood, and, you know, our own suffering kind of vanishes. If you do it for the motivation of eliminating your suffering, it won't work, okay? But if you really do it as a practice of love and compassion, then it transforms your mind, you know, right here and now. Okay, so bodhicitta is the medicine that alleviates all troubles. It's the great path traveled by all the knowledgeable persons. Okay, so in Buddhism, what we consider knowledgeable people aren't necessarily like Einstein and Niels Bohr and, you know, the great artists and musicians and so on. Because unless you have some sensitivity towards the Dharma teachings, then you're not really considered intelligent from a Dharma perspective, because, you know, you don't have the value system that is going to lead you to create virtue. Yeah. So an intelligent person is someone who knows what virtue is and knows what non-virtue is, wants to create the former, abandon the latter, and then goes about doing it. Yeah. So that's an intelligent person. Somebody may be intelligent in a worldly way, but actually extremely dumb in a Dharma way. Yeah, many people like that, in fact. Okay, so it says it's the great path traveled by all the knowledgeable persons. It's the nourishment for all beings who see, hear, remember, and come into contact with it. Okay, so anybody who sees, hears, remembers, or in any way comes into contact with, like, a teaching on bodhicitta, then, you know, it nourishes them. And if you think about it, even somebody only once in their whole life hears a little bit about bodhicitta, that's absolutely amazing and incredible in this world. Yeah, when you consider how many living beings there are on this planet, and how many have even heard one paragraph of teachings about bodhicitta, percentage-wise, hardly anybody. Yeah. Now, we may think it's very common because we hang around, you know, we're always generating bodhicitta every time we can in all of our motivations. But when you think, you know, do your families ever hear the word bodhicitta? Yeah. At work, did anybody hear it? Yeah. How many people outside of, you know, your Buddhist friends even heard it? And sometimes even our Buddhist friends haven't even heard of it. Yeah? So just even having one teaching on it nourishes the wholesome part of that person and plants such wonderful good seeds in them. It's that which has the great skill and means that engages you in others' welfare and thereby indirectly achieves your own welfare in its entirety. Yeah, that's, you know, what His Holiness's thing. If you want to be selfish, be wisely selfish and take care of others. So if you want to accomplish your own spiritual aims and attain the truth body, the omniscient mind of the Buddha, and its emptiness and true cessation, then you've got to take care of others, which means attaining a form body so you can manifest in different ways to be of great benefit to others. Okay, and bodhicitta is the motivation for doing all of that. Yeah, that's why bodhicitta is so important, because it's what gets us in motion. Yeah. Without the bodhicitta, you know, we wouldn't seek the Buddha's form body and truth body. We would just want to get out of our own samsara ASAP. Yeah, so it's the bodhicitta that like opens your mind, and you have to realize, oh, but there's other living beings, and they hurt as much as I hurt, and I have some responsibility, and I want to have that responsibility to be a benefit to them. Okay? And then, it's very sweet here, one who enters bodhicitta thinks, wonderful, I have found what I am looking for. Yeah? So it makes you even happier than getting the job that you always wanted to have. Yeah. Do you think the job you always wanted to have is going to bring you everlasting happiness? No, I don't think so. I remember years ago, you were leading a discussion group in DFF. Do you want to tell that story?
About the age difference?
Yeah, and about career, what they thought.
Yeah. So it was a refuge group, and people were talking. So it was just very clear in the group that it was about 50-50, people in their 30s and then people in their 50s and over. And how, as we were talking about the things that we take refuge in, the people in their 30s still couldn't, like, the Dharma was great, but their career was so important. That's what was going to make their life meaningful. It was so clear, the potential, the possibility of what they could do in the world, totally had to do with their career. And the people who were like over 50 were like so exhausted from having striven in their career and seeing that, and relationship too, and seeing that, you know, no matter how hard you try, it cannot fulfill the dream that you have when you're young.
Yeah. Because I remember you saying, you know, those people still think they're going to have career satisfaction. Yeah. Sorry. You came here to visit us in the book. But come back when you're 50 and we'll say we told you so. Okay, so we enter the Mahayana after we've developed great respect for the bodhicitta, induced by seeing its good qualities from various perspectives. So really thinking about the benefits of bodhicitta and how wonderful it is. Okay, so then some other benefits of bodhicitta is that there's no Mahayana vehicles other than the perfection vehicle, Paramityana, or the tantric vehicle, the Tantrayana. And whichever of these two you practice, the prerequisite is actually bodhicitta. Yeah. So that, when I say prerequisite, I mean in terms of entering the path of accumulation, really entering that vehicle. And the only entrance is generating bodhicitta. So if you want to be a Mahayana practitioner, bodhicitta is the way. Yeah. So you can't fudge it, you know. If you want to be that kind of practitioner, you can't say, well, can't I just have a little bit of self-centeredness? Yeah. When I'm a Buddha, can't I just have, you know, care about myself more than others, just 1% of the time? The answer is no. This is like all or nothing. Yeah, we can't hold anything back. We have to really give our heart into this. And no matter what other good qualities we have, even we've realized emptiness, if we don't have bodhicitta, we can't become fully awakened Buddhas. Okay, bodhicitta is the real key to the whole thing. Okay, so you know, becoming a bodhisattva, being called the victor's child, you know, all these synonyms for bodhisattva, they all come from generating the bodhicitta, not otherwise. And I remember so clearly when Lama Zopa was teaching this one time. And, you know, you can tell when he teaches bodhicitta that he's realized it. And he was talking about, you know, how generating bodhicitta depends on having that altruistic intention towards every single sentient being. Yeah. So if we leave any sentient being out, we can't have bodhicitta. And that each and every sentient being is a cause of our awakening, because it's by having love and compassion and altruism towards them that we're able to develop bodhicitta. So we should be grateful to other sentient beings for acting as the basis with which we generate bodhicitta that allows us then to progress to full awakening. So he was saying, you know, you look at every bug. I'm sure we have a bug around, we always do. Yeah, a stink bug somewhere, or, you know, some bug crawling around. But, you know, every single bug, yeah, okay, you know, every single bug is the cause of our bodhicitta. And it's so important that we generate love and compassion and altruism for that bug. Because if we leave that bug out, then we ourselves cannot attain full awakening. So it's very powerful sometimes. You know, here it's very good, you know, to sit outdoors when we have a lot of bugs. Yeah. So in the springtime when we have ticks, every single tick is the cause of my enlightenment. Every single tick. You know, then in the summer, every single yellow jacket is the cause of my enlightenment. In the autumn, every single stink bug is the cause of my awakening. In the winter, I think we just have the cats to rely on. Flies. Flies. Every single fly is the cause of my enlightenment. So it's very powerful, isn't it? You know? It's like, okay, I really have to open my heart very widely here. Yeah, which one do you have the hardest time opening your heart to?
Ticks.
Flies?
Ticks.
Ticks?
Yellow jackets.
Yellow jackets.
Snakes.
Snakes. Yeah, our snakes around here are kind of docile. Yeah.
Human beings.
Human beings! So, yeah, so whether it's human beings or bugs.
Ever woke up and debug you?
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, it's pretty vast. Okay. And here's a quote from Precious Garland. We haven't gotten to it yet, but this will give you some anticipation. If you and the world wish to attain unexcelled awakening, its root is the bodhicitta, firm as the king of mountains. Yeah, so that's the root of full awakening. That's it. And then also, so just as to enter the perfection vehicle, you know, practicing the six perfections according to the sutra explanation, we need bodhicitta to do that. Also, to actually enter the tantric vehicle, you know, to really enter it, not to enter it the way we do, but to really be a tantric practitioner, then you need bodhicitta. So there's a quotation here from the Tantra Bestowing the Initiation of Vajrapani. And Vajrapani is saying to Manjushri, once those who have entered meditation on bodhicitta have attained it, Manjushri, these bodhisattvas who practice the bodhisattva deeds, the door to Tantra, should enter into the tantric mandala of the great sublime wisdom initiation. However, those who have not fully attained bodhicitta should not enter it. They should not even enter and see the mandala. Moreover, do not teach them the gestures and mantras. So that's pretty straightforward, isn't it? You know? So, Sankapa says it's not sufficient that the person be, that the teaching be a tantric teaching. It's crucial that the person be a tantric practitioner. And it's crucial that the person be a monk. I messed this up. It's not sufficient that the teaching be a Mahayana teaching, but the person must be a Mahayana practitioner. Okay? Because we can listen to the Mahayana teachings a lot, but how the teachings go in to a person who is a genuine Mahayana practitioner, who has genuine spontaneous bodhicitta, how the teachings go into the mind of that person and how the teachings go into the mind of the rest of us, there's a big difference. Yeah. Okay. So, also he talks about bodhicitta is like the seed, the specific cause among the general causes of the sprout of Buddhahood. Okay, so bodhicitta is the seed. The effect is the sprout of Buddhahood. And bodhicitta is the specific cause among all of the general causes that are going to lead somebody to become a Buddha. Okay? So the wisdom that knows emptiness is the general cause of awakening. Why is it called the general cause? Because it's not specific just to the bodhisattva vehicle. Yeah? Here, solitary realizes everybody needs to realize emptiness. So it's the general cause for the awakening of all three vehicles. But it's the specific cause, but bodhicitta is the specific cause for attaining the full awakening of a Buddha. Okay? So in the same way that, you know, that the when you're growing a garden, your seed is the principal cause, and the water and fertilizer and good weather are the cooperative conditions. Here it's saying that bodhicitta is like the seed of awakening, and even the realization of emptiness is like a cooperative condition for full awakening, in the sense that if you don't have the bodhicitta, you may attain the hearer, solitary realizer awakening, but not the bodhisattva awakening, not full Buddhahood. Okay? Then another one from Nagarjuna's Precious Garland. I think we've hit this one already, or we're about to. Since I think it may, we did it even last night, okay? The translation here is probably a little bit different than the one we heard from the other translator. But since the aspirational prayers, deeds, and complete dedications of the bodhisattva are not explained in the hearer vehicle, then how could you become a bodhisattva through it? Okay, remember that? So, you know, the aspirational prayers and deeds, the aspirational prayers are aspirational motivations. It's not, I have some problem with the word prayer because usually we think of praying to somebody. And here it's generating these incredible great resolves, you know, these incredible determinations and aspirational prayers to do totally magnificent and great deeds for the benefit of sentient beings. Yeah. So it's more in the form of like really generating a motivation oneself, a resolve, I'm going to do this. Not, you know, may, you know, Manjushri manifest many bodies to benefit sentient beings while I go and eat some ice cream. Yeah, it's may I, you know, emanate many bodies to benefit sentient beings. Yeah, and, you know, kind of jumping in and doing those kind of aspirations. And then the deeds, those are the six perfections. And then the dedications of the bodhisattva. So again, the way bodhisattvas dedicate is like so expansive. Yeah. You can really tell the difference, you know, among different levels of practitioners according to how they dedicate. Worldly people, you know, what do they dedicate? Well, they usually don't dedicate, but what do they pray for? May I win the lottery? May I marry a nice person? May my children, you know, do all sorts of wonderful things. Yeah, isn't that what most people pray for? Yeah? And then, of course, the initial level practitioner prays, may I have a good rebirth? Yeah, which is good. That's better than just thinking about worldly pleasure. Yeah. And then even better than that, somebody in the hearer solitary realizer vehicle prays to attain liberation from samsara, which is also good. Are you thinking it's raining? Yeah, maybe it is. Maybe bodhisattvas. Yeah, when it snows here in the winter, I always think it's raining Chenrezis or Vajrasattvas. Yeah. Okay, and then, you know, bodhisattvas, they're going to make all these incredible dedications that even it's impossible to fulfill, but it's still good to generate that kind of aspiration. You know, like a bodhisattva will dedicate or will aspire, you know, may I manifest in the lowest hell realm and lead, you know, not may I, but I will manifest in the lowest hell realm and lead every single sentient being to full awakening. Yeah. We don't want anything to do with the hell realm, you know. But bodhisattvas say, you know, may I be born there and be a benefit to the beings living there. Huh? That's something, isn't it? So the idea, you know, what differentiates actually the hearer, solitary realizer, and bodhisattva vehicles is not the philosophical view, but the motivation and the deeds that you do motivated by that. That's the real thing. Okay. Oh, here's one of J. Rinpoche's, you know, suck it to you things. You know, he doesn't put up with our nonsense. Okay. So he says, you know, thus if you... he's saying Nagarjuna says that if you differentiate these vehicles, that you differentiate these vehicles not by philosophical view but by deeds. If in this way, even the wisdom that knows emptiness is not specifically Mahayana path, it goes without saying that there are other shared paths as well. Okay. Hence, it is a clear indication that you have very little familiarity with the teachings when, after you have taken the bodhicitta to be the crucial instruction, you do not practice it, but after recalling it at the beginning of a meditation session, only in words, you intently make great effort at some single small portion of the path. Okay? So, yeah, it's a clear indication you have very little familiarity with the teachings. If you think, wow, bodhicitta is such an important instruction, it's the heart of the Mahayana, it's this beautiful thing, I've got to practice it. You know, it's the cream of all the Buddha's teachings. And so you say that. But then, afterwards, you don't practice it. Yeah, six paramitas are out the window. And at the beginning of your meditation session, it's, you know, I take refuge until I can't remember the rest of it. May I attain full awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings. Yeah, okay, how long is this meditation session going to last? Yeah, my legs hurt already. I'm diminishing it. Here he's saying you intently make great effort at some single small portion of the path. What color are Tara's celestial silks? I'm trying to visualize Tara and I can't do it unless I know what color her celestial silks are.
Green and white, Tara.
Doesn't matter. I'm hung up on the celestial silks. Yeah. Maybe white are. What color are her celestial silks?
Kind of a white, no. Oh,
white. Oh, they can't be. That blends in too much.
Yeah.
Huh.
Blue.
Blue. What color? But different tonkas have different colors. One tonka she has green, one tonka she has pink. I'm so confused, I don't know how to meditate properly.
Just a change.
Yeah. You think Tara's clothes get dirty?
No.
No. So, in order to, remember last night we talked about the two extremes when we discussed non-abiding nirvana, the extreme of cyclic existence, the extreme of personal peace, yeah? So what is going to remedy the extreme of cyclic existence? Keep us from falling into or remaining in cyclic existence.
They want to be free from it, the liberation.
Yeah, it's wisdom that actually frees us from cyclic existence. What frees us from self-complacent nirvana?
Bodhicitta.
Okay. So that's why we need both of them. Why they say they're, those two are like the wings of a bird and you need both of them to fly. Okay. This is very sweet. Here's some verses from Shantideva. Yeah, this altruistic intention, which is not born in others, even for their own sake, is a special jewel of the mind, bringing an unprecedented wonder. Is there any virtue equal to this? Is there any such friend? Is there any such merit? I bow down to the body of anyone who has generated this sacred jewel of the mind. So he's saying, you know, why is there no virtue equal to bodhicitta? Because when we act motivated by bodhicitta, we collect stupendous, you know, merit because it's motivated by the intention to benefit all living beings. Yeah. It, when we do something that's even virtuous, you know, once in a while when we create some virtue, if we have the thought, you know, I'm going to benefit from this, then it benefits one person. Yeah. If we do the same action but do it with a bodhicitta, yeah, even if it's fabricated, made up bodhicitta, it's still stupendous because we're thinking, you know, I'm doing this for the benefit of all living beings. And how many people on this planet do anything for the benefit of others? You know, not so often. Not so often. Okay, is there any such friend? Yeah. When we're lonely, bodhicitta is our friend. Yeah, when you practice bodhicitta, there's no way you can be lonely. Yeah, but when we're lonely, bodhicitta is our best friend. You know, because we're thinking about the welfare of sentient beings, cultivating a good mental state. Yeah, bodhicitta is the best antidote against boredom and loneliness. It's our best friend. It keeps us company, yeah, no matter where we're at or what we're doing. So who knows what kind of situations we may find ourselves in our life. Yeah, you can find yourself in some pretty weird situations. But if you generate bodhicitta at that time, then bodhicitta is your friend there with you in that situation.
Yeah. What verse was that?
Hmm?
What verse was that?
Oh, it doesn't say. Or it says in the, it's footnote 16, but the, it's endnote actually, 16. So, but it's going to be in the first chapter. Okay, Shantideva also says, it's the quintessential butter churned from the milk of the sublime teaching. So we've never churned butter, but you know, or milk, you know, to get the cream, but or the butter. So, but this is like that. So it's like the best investment you could ever make. Yeah. You go to your investment broker and you want the best investment that's going to have the greatest income and the greatest benefits. And they're not going to sell you, you know, Apple or Microsoft or whatever. They're going to say, bodhicitta. Yeah, if you have a good financial investment, you know, consultant, they'll say, bodhicitta, that's the best one. Okay. So if you generate bodhicitta in an uncontrived manner, after making much effort, you will be imbued with the bodhicitta, and then even giving a tiny morsel of food to a crow will be considered a bodhisattva deed. Yeah. So every time you give even one bit of kibble to a kitty, it becomes the cause of full awakening if we have the bodhicitta. However, if you lack the bodhicitta, even offering a universe of 3 billion world systems filled with jewels will not be considered a bodhisattva deed. Yeah. Remember when we were talking about this in Precious Garland? Somebody who makes offerings of 350 pots of stew, you know, morning, evening, morning, lunch, and evening for however long to benefit sentient beings, isn't creating nearly the merit that somebody creates offering some small thing if with bodhicitta. Okay? And if your precious bodhicitta has not actualized the key point of the practice, no matter how long you try and cultivate virtue, you will not accomplish much. Okay, so it says, it's like cutting grass with a very dull sickle, or working out in the woods with loppers that just don't cut. Okay, whereas having bodhicitta in your actions, it's like having a new saw and new loppers, and everything works nicely. Okay. Okay, likewise, with this fully actualized bodhicitta, in each instant, you are able to easily clear away obscurations and accumulate the collections of merit and sublime wisdom. Again, more from Shantideva. The force of negativity is great and extremely intense. Besides the bodhicitta, what virtue can overcome it? Yeah. When you look in our world and you see the kind of negativity people are creating all over the place, you just read, you know, look at the news, and it's, I mean, what does the news mostly talk about? Yeah, and Musa talks about people creating negative karma. Yeah. Although yesterday I read one, it was about two high school football players who rescued a kitten who was drowning in a drain pipe. And I thought, wow, you know, especially high school guys, football players, yeah, their friends teased them, but they felt very good about what they did. So once in a while you read about some small good action like that. What's most of the news about? Yeah? People creating negativity. Okay, so when it says the force of negativity is great and extremely intense, yeah, that's not an exaggeration. So what besides the bodhicitta working for the benefit of all beings, wanting to help them, not only so that they have food and clothing and friendship and education, but helping them so that they can eliminate the cause of all poverty and all suffering from their mind, so that they can eliminate the afflictions, eliminate the cognitive obscurations. Yeah, that's the real way to be able to benefit sentient beings. Okay, so again, I'll read some more from Shantideva. He has here, like the fire at the end of the eon, it will instantly consume grave negativities. So things that we may have done in the past that we feel totally awful about having done, and we have like a tremendous feeling of remorse and like, how can I ever forgive myself? Generating bodhicitta is the virtue that can overcome that negativity. Yeah. Again, because it's geared towards the benefit of all beings. Like the fire at the end of an eon, it will instantly consume grave negativities. I just read that. If even those who think, I'll clear away just the headaches of living beings, have such a beneficial intention that they receive immeasurable merit, then what is there to say if one who aspires to clear away the immeasurable unhappiness of each being and to endow each with immeasurable good qualities. So again, just showing the difference in the motivation that leads to a difference in behavior. Again, from Shantideva, all other virtues are like the plantain tree. After bearing fruit, they perish. But this bodhicitta is like a wish-granting tree, always bears fruit and never dies, but flourishes. Yeah? So we want to have the trees that never die. Yeah. We just looked in the area, you were saying, where we cleared some trees earlier in the year, and trees that were green then are now dying. Yeah, I mean, it happens like that a tree dies. But here we're talking about a tree that is gonna last forever, and a wish-granting tree in the sense that it grants every wish that every sentient being could possibly have or hope for. Okay. Where are we? So, questions, comments? Yeah?
What is like the good way to understand that to be fully awakened, we have to really care for each and every sentient being? Mm-hmm. Like comparing a bug with a human being.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, something doesn't click. Like when we pray at night, for, like we say, the two spiders that die in Tara and that person that die, to me, it's like, how?
Yeah, okay.
It's like a shock.
Right. So how can you really think of all sentient beings when sentient beings have such diverse lives, such diverse bodies, such diverse mental capacities? How can you compare a spider to a human being and pray for the benefit of each one?
And to have a good rebirth for both.
Yeah, or to have a good, for each one to have a good rebirth. Well, spiders want happiness and not suffering, and people also want happiness and don't suffer. And also, human beings are not always human beings. Those people who are human beings now in a previous life might have been spiders. Okay? And beings who are spiders now, if some virtuous karma ripens at the end of their spider rebirth, they may take rebirth as a human being. So it's not that everybody's always in one realm or another. Okay? So when you think like that, then yes, it's true human beings have greater wisdom, but, well, greater capacity. I shouldn't say greater wisdom. They have greater capacity, but those beings who are human beings aren't always going to be human beings. And the spiders and the ticks aren't always going to be bugs, you know, because different karma can ripen in different lives. Yeah. So we need to have a big mind and in that way see all living beings as equal. Yeah. No matter what their rebirth is now, because in some time, they're all going to be in different bodies and different rebirths. Okay. Also, you know, we have the habit of favoring human beings because we're one. Yeah, so we always favor our own team. But, when you look, spiders only kill living beings when they're hungry. Yeah, human beings kill other living beings for sport,
for money,
to plunder them, to get even, for honor. You know, human beings kill for all sorts of reasons. Yeah, a bug would never kill anybody for out of honor or for money. Yeah, or to say that they're brave to get some status. You know, I'm a brave bug.
Or because they were angry.
Yeah. Well, they might because they were angry. If they were endangered.
A bug.
Well, that's why wasps bite us if they feel endangered.
They feel threatened.
Yeah.
There's a difference between feeling threatened and feeling anger.
Yeah, but usually when beings feel threatened, the usual reaction is anger. Yeah, most of the time.
I might argue that with you.
Oh, that's okay. You know I'm right.
I'm threatened here, you know.
But I'll make you angry.
and also, all the lesson that came to us to teach us, it can be any kind of object.
Mm-hmm.
Remember you were walking and you saw the tree and you had things around attached, you know, of the tree, and you felt, oh, that's how I feel, tight, you know. And then you saw the tree, and you said, oh, yeah, that's what I want to attain, that freedom. A bug, a flower, we don't know what is behind that, ever.
Mm-hmm.
Could be a Buddha that is just took that form to give us a teaching.
Yeah.
Teachings come in any form.
Right. Yeah. It's true. Not just from human beings, but from
spiders. We can
from spiders.
Touched by
Yeah.
Bug or an animal or
One of my friends, very dear Dharma friend, we lived in India in the same time period. And India has these really big spiders. Okay, so he didn't like those spiders very much. And he had an uncle that he was very, very fond of. And his uncle died. And it was really, you know, kind of painful for him. And he told me that one day he looked in his room and there was one of those big spiders. And you know, his first thought was, bleh. And then his next thought was, maybe that's my uncle. And he said after that, he didn't have that same kind of reaction towards spiders anymore.
That helped me to think that way too, like this might be somebody that I love. The other thing that helped me was to look at the bugs, just watch them and, you know, I started calling them all Clyde. No, before I did that, I used to just think of them as little nanotechnology things. I didn't really see them as living beings.
Mm-hmm.
It was raised with a kind of ignorance. It was definitely raised with a kind of ignorance.
Yeah. So often we don't see bugs as living beings. And in some religions, it's said that God created bugs for our benefit, so we can do with them whatever we want.
Yeah, I was thinking about that today when I was walking, or yesterday, about dominion over the beast or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I want to reinterpret that as caretakers.
Yeah, instead of dominion over the beast, caretakers of living beings.
The meaning of dominion was taken as caretakers, like you have this power of mind, and so you should be taking care of all these other
things. Mm-hmm. Instead of dominating them. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how can you work on generating bodhicitta for someone who is cruel? They are suffering and probably need it the most, but this is very difficult.
Yeah, people, I remember when at Kapan people would raise their hand, Lama, how do you generate, you know, great compassion? Which, by the way, is not the same as bodhicitta. But how do you generate it's a cause of bodhicitta, so it comes before. How do you generate great compassion for Joseph Stalin and Mao Zedong and Adolf Hitler? You know, how do you do it? And Lama, you know, after he learned what these people were, he said, "They means well, dear."
What?
His English was not so good. "They means well, dear. They mean well." And we were all, Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Mao Zedong meant well. You know, but they killed like millions of living beings each. And Lama explained, you know, in their mind, they thought that what they were doing was going to bring them happiness. That's how thoroughly confused they were, that they thought their murderous behavior was going to bring them and the world happiness. But when he said they meant well, it was like, you know, they thought that was going to bring others happiness. I mean, that's how totally skewed and confused the mind was. And then he would also say, they love their family. Yeah. And I remember, you know, sometimes talking with people whose family was in the SS in World War II, yeah, and now, you know, the descendants are completely against that. But, you know, people who remembered that their father was an SS soldier, but their father was so kind and loving to them. Yeah. So Lama's point was, nobody is completely evil. That we can't sign off some human beings saying they're completely evil and have no value. But everybody has some kindness in them. So it's a big thing to swallow. But when you think, you know, because we're used to just, you know, generate an opinion about somebody, put them in a category, and, you know, forget it. Think bad thoughts about them. So this is really challenging our tendency to do that and to see that everybody can change and that everybody has multiple sides to them. Somebody's not all one thing or all the other. Yeah?
I was just going to comment that sometimes we take one small observation about a person, we identify forevermore that person with that one quality, almost yep. disregarding every other visible aptitude, quality, or behavior that that person might have.
Yeah.
And forever becomes...
Yeah, that's very true. Somebody does one small thing that we don't like, and that person's a bad person, and no matter what else they do afterwards that is really wonderful and exceptional, we cannot let any new information about them into our mind. We are thoroughly prejudiced over one small, small thing. So human beings sometimes, we're not very smart.
Sometimes.
Yeah?
For me, bodhicitta, when I was younger, I called it unconditional love. Mm-hmm. That it always spoke to me, even if I had difficulty with it. But what I see, I was listening to the politics, you know, what's going on right now. And the tea person, I said, "You have a tea person in you."
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, what he says. Oh. I did reflect that I have that in me.
Mm-hmm.
And those difficult persons,
my mind is able to be there. I was, they only showing you a part of you that is closed,
mm-hmm.
that is not open.
Yeah.
And
so very often somebody, the person that we condemn the most and dislike the most, has a trait that we have.
Yes.
Or even if we don't have that trait as explicitly, we certainly have that potential within us. And we don't like to acknowledge that within ourselves.
Mm-hmm. How can we advise an elderly person who is not a Buddhist and has no religion of loneliness and insecurity?
How do you ask an elderly person who's not religious, and give them some advice to reduce their loneliness and insecurity? Tell them to think good thoughts about other people and to wish other people well. And if they're lonely, sit on a park bench and watch the people go by and send them all very good wishes. Instead of judging them, you know, even though they're strangers, in your mind think a good thought and send them a good wish. Now, whether the person would do that or not, I don't know. But that's probably what I would advise. Yeah? Or I maybe give them one of His Holiness's books that is not particularly Buddhist. Maybe something like, Universe in a Single Atom, if they were interested in science, or his book Beyond Religion, or what's the secular ethics book? Ethics for a New Millennium, or Art of Happiness. You know, one of those books, and give it to him to read. It has good ideas in it.
Or if they can't read, read it to them.
Yeah, or if they can't read, read it to them. Even if they fall asleep on you. Yeah, because sometimes old people, you know, they'll fall asleep on you. That's okay. Yeah.
You said that if you do the taking and giving meditation, the motivation to eliminate your own suffering, then it won't work.
Mm-hmm.
So does that also apply to using antidotes to mental afflictions? You're just trying to eliminate
your
own suffering?
Oh, no. What's your own experience when you use an antidote because you're having mental suffering because there's an affliction? Does it work?
Not very well.
But as you practice more, does it begin to work?
Sometimes.
Yeah. You know, so even you're trying to remove your own pain by using, practicing an antidote, it works. Yeah. What I'm talking about here with the taking and giving meditation is because it involves actually thinking of people's suffering and imagining taking their suffering from them and using it to demolish your own self-centeredness, that you can't really do that meditation with any feeling if you're thinking, if by imagining this, I'm going to eliminate my own suffering. Okay? To do that meditation with any kind of feeling, you have to really, you know, as much as you can, put aside your self-preoccupation. Or to, if you're going to relate it to your own suffering, to say, okay, my stomach hurts now, but may my stomach hurting suffice for all the people who have stomach aches. And then you imagine all these people who have stomach aches and taking their misery of stomach aches from them and taking that on and then using it to demolish your own self-centeredness. That's what I meant. Anything else? Okay. So, you know, think about the benefits of bodhicitta. They're really quite something. And also, you know, if you just think about, you know, those beings who are bodhisattvas, that it's, for me to think, you know, it's actually possible to generate that thought, cherishing others more than self, and to work very hard to attain full awakening with that motivation, you know, both those components, that there actually are people who do that, and that there actually is a method to practice to be able to become like that. I mean, it just fills your heart with joy and amazement and, you know, and this feeling of tremendous good fortune of having met these teachings.
The interesting thing to me with that is that when you do that, you become very happy. Mm-hmm. And yet, we don't step into that. All the, you know, it's
yeah.
So curious.
Yeah, that when we, that's the, yeah, what's very interesting is we feel so much more comfortable being self-centered, even though we're miserable when we're self-centered. But to step into cherishing others more than self is scary, even though when we do it, we feel happier. Okay? So this is the depth of our confusion and ignorance. That it's so hard for us to even recognize what is good for us.
Mm-hmm. And I've also found with Stephen's question about the taking and giving is that I don't, to counteract the self-centered thought, because when I get sick, the self-concern becomes so great, is that what helps me so much is to realize that I'm not alone in my suffering. Mm-hmm. And so when I think about like all the lung stuff that I've had in my life, when I think very, very specifically about all the people in the world that have difficulties, whether it's emphysema or black lung or bronchitis or fibrosis, or I put myself in the company of other people who are struggling with that.
Yeah.
And it just totally, my whole self-concern just vanishes.
Yeah.
And there is this heart opening. Mm-hmm. That then gives me the capacity that says, and may I be able to take on that suffering.
Yeah.
You know, because we're all suffering together. And since I'm here doing it right now, why don't I do it? But it puts me in the company of others rather than me being alone in my self-preoccupation about how badly I feel.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, because that's true. When we're in pain, we just become so focused on ourselves, we can't think of anybody or anything else. And that actually makes it more painful.
Physical or mental pain.
Hmm?
Mental or physical pain.
Yeah, mental or physical pain. Yeah. And so, and we tend to have more mental pain in this country than physical pain. But, if you know, when you have mental pain or physical pain, if you think of all the other people who have that same problem and that same pain, and it's like, you know, mine, compared to all the pain from just that one problem, not even all the other problems that sentient beings have, but my pain is actually rather small in comparison. Yeah? And so as long as I'm experiencing it, may I take on that of others? Yeah? Because we do see, you know, we're not the only one hurting. And, you know, that self-centeredness makes us so miserable because it isolates us from others, and we think we're the only one who has ever hurt this much. Nobody else can possibly understand. And yet all sentient beings have been in that situation one time or another. What we're experiencing is not anything new that nobody else has ever, that, you know, nobody else has ever experienced this. That's not the case. And thinking that, it does, it releases it a lot for us. But then one part of our mind says, mine hurts more than theirs do. And even though theirs hurts a lot, nobody's thinking about me while I'm suffering. I'm thinking about them, but nobody's thinking about me. What? All the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas aren't thinking about you? They're not doing taking and giving for you? They're doing it, but we're holding on to our suffering. Yeah. Oh, that it's hard for you to get your mind that big.
I mean, sometimes, but oftentimes I don't. It's hard. There's certain things in this that I can't seem to rock.
Yeah, and that's why we have to keep at it, you know? There's certain things, and we all have different things that are hard for us to understand.
You know what I realized recently, though? That I think part of my problem with this is that there's a problem there. I didn't really realize that until this, a few, like in the last 3 weeks, where I was like, no wonder I can't do this. Because you have this relationship when you're a kid and how you're thinking about all this, and there's something in that that makes them very unavailable. You can't ever be that. I don't know, it's just really strange. It's just, it's kind of like I've realized that this is part of what's in the way. I can't break outside of some kind of mold.
So even thinking of that Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are thinking about you and trying to lead you out of pain. It's like the mind says, I can't relate to that. Yeah. Because when you were raised as a kid, God was like, yeah, unavailable. Your pain was his will. It's good when you see those things, because then you can start investigating it. You know, what kind of thing is hanging out in the back of my mind?
I'm glad that you brought that up, because never, ever, I would have thought that the Buddhas and the Bodhisattva would do that.
Yeah.
I've never heard that before, and I would never have thought.
Yeah. Even though we hear so many teachings about the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, cherishing others more than self, working so hard to attain enlightenment for the benefit of sentient beings, we never think that we're included in that. Yeah? We hear about that, but somehow the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are working for the benefit of everybody else, but not me.
See, my I believe in it. Now I will think of, oh, I don't think you know.
Yeah.
Never, ever.
Yeah.
We
never think of ourselves as objects of other people's compassion. But we are.
But I was just not just thinking about me, I was thinking about everybody, I think. That the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas would do that.
Yeah. No, I understand, because we hear all these things, and we say, oh yeah, that's nice, but we don't really
do that.
I know one time I went to see Geshe Nawandarge, and I don't know what we were talking about, but he said, every night I pray for my students. And I was shocked. It never entered my mind that my teachers would ever pray for their students, when it's so, like, duh, obvious.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah. It's so obvious. But when he said that, I was, like, shocked. Really? You pray for people like me? You dedicate for people like me?
yesterday. A woman fell down some steps, and I don't think she broke her leg, but she injured it quite badly and went off to the hospital. And in the next session, Rinpoche said, I made lots of preparatory prayers that everything would go smoothly, no one would be hurt. I guess I didn't pray hard enough, which of course is not the case, but I think he was making the point. He was letting us know in a similar way.
Yeah.
I'm doing things ahead of time, I'm doing things now, I'm doing things in the future. I'm constantly praying for
my students. Yeah. And we never think that they are. Yeah, they're always
unavailable,
and involved in them themselves, just like we are. Or they're praying for other students, but the good students, not for me. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They can do nothing for us. So why do we do exchange? They can do nothing.
Yeah,
for
they
us.
Can't do anything for us. But they can.
Yeah, that's where I need to work.
Yeah.
It's funny though, when I think about seeing the last time I saw Dasha Rinpoche or the last time I saw Geshe Sopa, I have to say they weren't sticking around for themselves.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
They did these things for us.
Yeah. Yeah. So you could tell by seeing two of your teachers, quite older, elderly Geshe Sopa and Dachen Rinpoche. Yeah.
Close to death, still climbing up these stairs with knees that don't work to get on this throne. Not even teeth in his mouth.
Yeah.
Not even teeth in his mouth either. Mm-hmm. He had false teeth.
Yeah. Doing things for others, yeah. Okay, let's dedicate.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Bosan's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Idam Gura Namandala Kambiryatayami.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Floor.